Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On November 5th, 2007, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the Kentucky Department of Revenue versus Davis case. The court was asked to consider whether or not a state law that taxes interest income for bonds issued by another state and local governments while exempting interest income from in-state bonds violates the Commerce Clause. In this episode of SCOTUS Cast, Professor Brannon Denning of the Cumberland School of Law, Samford University, discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society itself takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Denning.
Welcome to the Federalist Society SCOTUS Cast. My name is Brannon Denning. I'm a professor of law at the Cumberland School of Law, which is located in Birmingham, Alabama, on the campus of Samford University. I'll be talking today about an important Dormant Commerce Clause case argued yesterday, November 5th, entitled Department of Revenue for the Commonwealth of Kentucky versus Davis. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the facts in the Davis case, how it got to the court. Next, I'm going to lay out some principles for the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine that are central to the case. I'll briefly describe the basic arguments made by the parties in their briefs. Then I'll discuss the reaction of the court to both sides' argument during oral argument that was held yesterday. And finally, I'll hazard a prediction about what the court is likely to do. The facts of the case are relatively simple. Kentucky, like virtually all other states with an income tax, exempts the income derived from bonds that it or its municipalities issue while taxing income derived from bonds issued by other states or their local governments. A group of Kentucky taxpayers, including the respondents, the Davises, sued, arguing that this discriminatory treatment of out-of-state bonds violated the so-called Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. A trial court in Kentucky upheld that exemption. That decision was reversed by the Kentucky Court of Appeals. Then, surprisingly, the Kentucky Supreme Court declined to review the lower court's decision, and the state petitioned for a writ of certiorari, in part because if the decision of the lower court were to stand, the state would be facing millions of dollars of potential liability in refund suits. Further, some states' bonds would become less attractive investment vehicles if the income tax exemption were not available. Therefore, states might also be facing not only refund suits, but also prospectively a loss of revenue going forward. The case is also important because it, along with the case from last term that I will discuss in a minute, might signal the most significant narrowing of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine in over 75 years. Let me now sketch the outlines of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine before addressing the party's specific arguments in the Davis case. The Constitution confers on Congress the power to regulate interstate and foreign commerce, as well as commerce with the Indian tribes. In addition to that affirmative grant of power, the court has, for well over a century, assumed that implicit in that grant were restrictions on the power of states to regulate interstate commerce. Now, the court has never quite been clear why it infers these restrictions, which don't appear explicitly in the text, but the court seems to have settled on the theory lately that the framers intended to end the sort of state-on-state economic predation that hampered interstate cooperation under the old Articles of Confederation. The doctrine itself has undergone considerable changes over the years and even developed separate tests depending on whether the state law was a tax or a non-tax regulation. For our purposes, though, this case involves a tax, the main Dormant Commerce Clause principle involved, which I'll call the anti-discrimination principle, is applied the same whether the law at issue is a tax or a non-tax regulation. The anti-discrimination principle is simply the principle that states may not treat out-of-state economic activity less favorably than the same activity occurring in-state. This is true whether the unfavorable treatment comes through the use of the state's tax laws or through the use of the state's police power. The sole exception is if the state can prove that it was pursuing a, quote, legitimate governmental interest, close quote, which means basically one that is not economically protectionist in nature, and that legitimate interest cannot be achieved by any less discriminatory means than those that were employed by the state. Traditionally, this is a relatively strict standard that few laws that are facially discriminatory can survive, facially discriminatory meaning that the differentiation between in-state and out-of-state economic activity appears on the face of the statute. At this point, you might be asking why the court is even hearing the case. If the anti-discrimination principle is so well established and the Kentucky law is facially discriminatory, the Kentucky Court of Appeals got it right, right? Well, last term, in a case entitled United Haulers versus Oneida Herkimer Solid Waste Authority, the court held that a state may discriminate in favor of a publicly owned facility in a way that the anti-discrimination would prohibit if the facility were privately owned, at least where a traditional governmental activity was involved. Because it's important to the Davis case, let me describe a little bit the facts of United Haulers. United Haulers involved a publicly owned waste transfer station, built and designed to process waste collected in two New York counties, Oneida and Herkimer. The Oneida-Herkimer Solid Waste Authority required that all waste collected in those two counties be processed there. In other words, there couldn't be any exporting of garbage by haulers who might prefer to have it processed more cheaply elsewhere. On almost identical facts, the court held in a case entitled CNA Carbone versus Clarkstown that such a forced use requirement violated the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine's anti-discrimination principle. In United Haulers, however, the court distinguished Carbone. Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the opinion for plurality, argued that simple economic protectionism was not motivating the desire to ban the waste exportation. Rather, the county was simply trying to solve a waste collection problem by building its own waste processing facility and to ensure that facility's financial viability by ensuring it had sufficient volume of garbage to process. This, the court said, was an exercise of traditional police powers. Moreover, the court noted that the restriction was even-handed in the sense that all garbage, whether hauled by in-state or out-of-state collectors, had to be processed at the Oneida-Herkimer facility. There was no favoritism. Finally, the court concluded that the restriction really harmed the citizens of those counties themselves, in the sense that they would have to pay more for garbage service, and that they could resort to the ballot box if necessary. In other words, the court thought that the political process, that enough citizens were, local citizens were affected, that the political process could serve to police any abuses. Obviously, analogies could be made between the traditional governmental function of garbage collection and that of raising money for public projects through the use of state and municipal bonds. And certainly, counsel for Kentucky made those arguments repeatedly in their briefs and at oral arguments. In addition, I mention this because it's important. Any dormant commerce clause claim brought by anyone now that comes to the court is behind in the count, so to speak, because Justice Clarence Thomas has announced in several recent decisions that he simply won't enforce the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine anymore. In other words, he will never vote to strike down a state or local law under the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. For his part, Justice Antonin Scalia, a longtime critic of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine, has said that he will enforce it only against facially discriminatory laws or in cases whose facts are identical to those facts in cases where the court had previously invalidated a law, a sort of stare decisis position. Let's turn now to the arguments made by both the parties. The state of Kentucky made several arguments, its main one being that the state had the power to tax the bonds of sister states while exempting its own from taxation, and that this was not discrimination in any constitutionally relevant sense, because the bonds themselves were not similarly situated. Kentucky bonds raised revenue for Kentucky projects. No other state issued bonds to fund Kentucky projects. The other main argument of the state was that United Haulers' decision compelled the reversal of the lower court's decision because the public financing through bond issuances was a traditional governmental function, just as garbage collection was in the United Haulers case. The state included a couple of other arguments, too, the main one being that reliance interests and expectations mandated reversal. That is, that allowing this lower court decision to stand would really upset the bond market and cause financial pain to states who would be forced to refund taxes that were collected in the past and forego further revenue if their securities were no longer attractive to investors without the tax exemption. The respondents, the Davis's briefs, contained replies to the numerous arguments put forth by the Commonwealth. The main argument was that the court has rarely upheld facially discriminatory regulations or taxes, and that only if the state satisfied the stringent scrutiny the court had required in the past should the lower court's decision be reversed. Obviously, the respondents felt that burden hadn't been met. Specifically, respondents argued that simple economic protectionism was motivating these state laws, that states were doing this in part to hoard capital within their states, making their bonds more attractive, enabling them to capture more of the revenue from a nationwide bond market and retain it at home to fund local projects. Further, respondents noted that the fact that these income tax exemptions had proliferated were evidence of a low-level trade war going on among the states, that New York had first done this in the early 20th century, and that other states rapidly followed suit. That kind of trade war, the respondents argued, were was precisely the thing that the Commerce Clause and the Dormant Commerce Clause were intended to forestall. Finally, they said that any reliance interests were insufficient to permit the laws to stand because states had known for several years that these laws were vulnerable under the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. Vanderbilt Law Professor Jim Blumstein had, in fact, written an article over 30 years ago raising this very point. Finally, respondents also denied that any of the relevant exceptions to the Dormant Commerce Clause apply. What was striking about oral argument, or at least the transcript that I read of it, is what a relatively easy time Kentucky's counsel had from the court. He was able to reserve 12 minutes for rebuttal and didn't seem to use all of that time at the end. Only the dissenters in United Haulers, Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy in particular, questioned him sharply, asking whether the myriad distinctions he was asking the court to make would render the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine incoherent or untenable. By contrast, counsel for the respondents were peppered with questions from members of the United Haulers majority about his position. He almost seemed at points to plead with the justices simply to apply the principles enunciated in many previous cases about facially discriminatory laws being subject to an almost, as one court decision put it, a virtually per se rule of illegitimacy. By the questioning, however, the justices seemed more interested in looking for a way to distinguish this case from prior ones or to fit it within the rule announced last term in the United Haulers case. Now, predicting the outcome of Supreme Court cases is hazardous business. I still remember standing around a family Thanksgiving dinner in 2000 patiently explaining why there was no way that the court would intervene and hear arguments about the vote in Florida. Nevertheless, I think it is safe to say that the court is likely to reverse the Kentucky Appeals Court. It could do so either by saying that Kentucky bonds and those of other states aren't really similarly situated, so that disparate treatment of income derived from each isn't really discrimination in a constitutionally relevant sense. Or it could extend the rule in United Haulers to this case, analogizing the raising of funds through bond issuances that receive favorable tax treatment to the forced use of a public garbage processing facility. Other paths are possible, but they would entail more substantial tinkering with the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine itself. However much Justices Thomas and Scalia might like that outcome, I think that other justices in the majority will likely pursue a narrower course. You've been listening to the Federalist Society's SCOTUS Cast. I'm Brandon Denning of the Cumberland School of Law in Birmingham, Alabama. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.